This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
White supremacy and those systems really got played out to divide and conquer our peoples. But we have to look at healing from that collective trauma and how we can undo that harm caused by colonization and systems of imposed white supremacy that came along with it.
The list of crimes committed in the name of so-called progress includes modern offenses, such as the Trump administration's effort to sell off Native American lands to oil and gas prospectors, as well as historical atrocities like the slaughter and theft perpetrated against indigenous populations across the globe. Our guest today on Sea Change Radio works to amplify First Peoples' voices in the fight for climate justice. This week we speak with the Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action, Ariel Duranger. We discuss the intersection of the Indigenous peoples and the Black Lives Matter movements, take a look at her organization's latest climate report, and get an update on the Keystone XL pipeline. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ariel Duranger. She is the Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action. Ariel, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you first tell us the mission of your organization?
Well, we're Canada's premier and only Indigenous-led climate justice organization. And our organization was really founded out of a need for Indigenous communities to have a central organization that focused on Indigenous-led climate justice. And our main mandate is to create resources and tools and training for Indigenous communities to be leaders in driving Indigenous-led climate solutions and addressing Canada's climate crisis.
And you have a new Indigenous climate policy white paper out that maybe you can summarize and then talk about what you're hoping it turns into.
Yeah. So, you know, some of the biggest challenges are is why do we need Indigenous-led climate solutions? It's a big question. You know, Canada constantly states that the relationship with Indigenous communities is one of their highest priorities in the country. Yet we're still developing policy, and particularly climate policy, without the participation of Indigenous peoples. And some of the questions sort of from the larger ENGO and government world is, well, what's wrong with the policy? Like, what's wrong with the actual policy that we're creating? And so this critique looks at, A, how the processes for the development of the Pan-Canadian Framework on Clean Growth and Climate Change and a Healthy Environment and Healthy Economy, the two primary climate policies and plans of the Canadian government, excluded really investigates whether these plans aim at the root causes of climate change while also respecting and meaningfully including Indigenous peoples and our rights, knowledges, and approaches to climate action. And it also examines the efficiency of the PCF, or the Pan-Canadian Framework, and the Healthy Economies, Healthy Environment reports in driving meaningful action towards stopping catastrophic climate change. So are these reports actually going to get us to the line of stopping climate change? And do they actually address root causes and include Indigenous peoples in the development and approaches to climate action in the country? And so that was kind of the main aim of this report. And, you know, lo and behold, we found out that the policy development and the frameworks for the development of policy structurally excluded Indigenous peoples from the development of these, you know, very broad-based policies for addressing climate change, and in fact violated the rights of Indigenous peoples and conflicted with federal commitments to nation-to-nation, Inuit Crown, government-to-government relationships, and in addition to the many calls to action from federal inquiries and reports like the TRC, the National Inquiry, and so on and so forth. So just really highlighting some serious deficiencies in how policies are developed. And the last piece is that a lot of the proposed solutions ignored realities faced by Indigenous peoples in Canada, who are in fact some of the most adversely and the first to be hit by the impacts of climate change in the country. And it overlooked the structural inequities reproduced by colonialism and other oppressive structures that have gotten us into the climate crisis we're in.
So can you walk us through sort of the logistics of how the latter stages of this report could and hopefully will evolve from your organization? Are you hoping for it to be read in Parliament? Are you interfacing with politicians? Maybe you can kind of expand on that.
Yeah. So the approach that we're taking is a little different. You know, we're a little different in our approach just generally. We really feel that communities, Indigenous communities across the country, have the right to sovereignty, self-determination, and the autonomy on determining how to address and participate in the development of climate policy in the country. And so we don't want to act on behalf of Indigenous communities. And this is a critique, an analysis of the fact that, yes, Indigenous peoples were structurally excluded from the development of these policies. And we want to engage and invite Indigenous communities to understand these policies are being created without your participation. In addition, these policies, in fact, in some instances, are in direct violation and contravention with our rights as Indigenous peoples. And we see this, like that example, largely in the fact that the policies, the Canadian policies, largely look at reduction of emissions, but also maintaining status quo or business as usual in the oil and gas sector through the development of offset programs, and how those actually don't address some of the root causes of the structural inequities of access to power and the continuation of our culture as Indigenous peoples, our lands and territories, as well as the fact that fossil fuels are one of the main contributors to catastrophic climate change. And so we believe that knowledge is power for our communities. And we want both governments, the environmental and non-governmental sector, and the public to recognize and acknowledge that these deficiencies exist in our current report, and that we should and could do better. And we have a phase two that involves the development of an advisory committee or council, which we already have in formation, and another research phase on what would decolonial climate policies in Canada look like through the creation of an Indigenous-led advisory committee in relation to interviews and community engagement strategies over the next year to present and table some actual recommendations.
It's a real challenge because climate change is such a vast template to work from, and so is the climate justice movement. So you're trying to kind of carve out the piece of climate change and fossil fuel companies' actions and how they impact specifically the Indigenous communities in Canada. But a lot of the policies that you set forth would actually help all Canadians, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's exactly it. So the reality is we don't want to say that nothing in the report or the policies and plans that Canada has created is worth anything. There is important work that's being done, and there are obvious signs of improvements between the relationships of Indigenous peoples in Canada with the colonial structures and governments. However, there are still serious problems that still need to be addressed if climate policy in Canada is to be just and effective. So it's both. So it's not just about like ensuring that Indigenous peoples have access to lands and territories. It's about that and creating real targets, real frameworks that address the inequities, but also get us closer to those targets of meeting our commitments to the Paris Agreement, as well as achieving climate stabilization. And it's not just about fossil fuels as well. Like, I mean, we have to talk about the suite, literally the suite of false solutions that are being proposed as a way to achieve targets for emissions reductions that don't actually acknowledge the inequities and the systems of oppression that continue to play out. Like we can't consider mega hydro, you know, projects like Muskrat Falls or Site C, which have been contested by Indigenous communities, as sustainable energy systems. We have to like really think about how do we create a just future that is much more sustainable and takes into consideration the original peoples of this country and works towards truth and reconciliation, which we talk about all the time, but we're still lacking ways to implement it and put it into action.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me, the Bill of Rights froze me, in jails they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull me upon me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to the Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action, Ariel Deranger. One issue that we've covered for close to a decade running now here on Sea Change Radio has been the Keystone XL pipeline. Mm-hmm. And I know it was a very important topic with the tar sands element in Canada. Maybe you can kind of update our listeners with what's going on with Keystone XL and how this fight has energized a lot of your work.
Yeah, you know, the Keystone and the tar sands is such an interesting, story to really sort of demonstrate the power of Indigenous campaigning and Indigenous rights as a way to change the course of climate policy, really. So the Keystone Pipeline was this massive proposed pipeline. It's been referred to as the zombie pipeline. It's kind of a wild story. So it's what makes it so interesting is it's a binational project that obviously starts in Alberta in my people's territory in Treaty 8. So I'm a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. And this pipeline for over 10 years has been at the core or the center of a bunch of dissent over what it means to expand dirty fossil fuels or bottom of the barrel fossil fuels like the tar sands. And we use tar sands as an example because it's not your sweet conventional crude oil. This is like a dirty heavy fossil fuel that needs to be refined multiple times to be considered a synthetic crude oil that it's just highly energy intensive, highly water intensive, and highly destructive to ecosystems that exist in Canada's boreal forests or the lands and the territories of the Dene, the Cree, and the Métis peoples of those regions. And that these pipelines are then carrying these massive, dirty fossil fuels across and traversing other Indigenous peoples' territories and river systems and waterways that are critical for the survival of those communities even further to that. And the protests around this were largely around like these pipelines, when they burst, because it's not about if they will, it's when they burst, what will the implications be? And it's not just about, oh, we can just clean it up because we've found out through the Kalamazoo spills that cleaning up tar sands is next to impossible because of the diluents or the solvents they have to add and the fact that it's a heavy oil that sinks to the bottom. And within this context, it raised questions not just about land and the rights of Indigenous peoples to protect their lands or say no to projects that traverse it, but it raises the question of like, why are we even developing dirty bottom of the barrel fossil fuels in a climate crisis? And why is it that it's Indigenous peoples that are advocating at the forefronts or the front lines of these projects, speaking out to protect their lands and territories in relation to their identities? Our identities are intrinsically tied to our lands and territories. And so the Keystone XL is protested. And the really beautiful thing is that these protests were not just led by Indigenous folks, but, you know, there was the Cowboy Indian Alliance in the United States that was ranchers and rural folks. And these, we started to see where the values of, you know, settler colonial society and Indigenous peoples were meeting. And the conversation wasn't just about having our rights respected as Indigenous peoples, but how having our rights respected were critical to us also meeting our commitments to addressing the climate crisis. And this was acknowledged when Biden was elected, and one of his first executive orders was to cancel the Keystone XL because he acknowledged its implications to the climate crisis, but also to the fact that these projects were abrogating and violating the rights of Indigenous communities. And we can start to see those direct ties between how the Keystone XL is directly tied, and the rights of Indigenous peoples are directly tied to climate solutions.
And how would the Biden administration's actions on Keystone XL influence political action in Canada?
I think, you know, the actions by Biden sent a signal to the Alberta tar sands sector, obviously very distinctly that sector, that this type of energy, again, dirty, bottom of the barrel energy sector, highly destructive, is not something we should be leaning into anymore. That there is, the tides have shifted and we need to shift with them. Now, I wouldn't, obviously, as a Alberta, a person from the province of Alberta, our premier, Jason Kenney, has not been very happy about that. There were threats of suing the U.S. government for breaking contracts for, you know, importing our oil and so on and so forth. Little bits of temper tantrums. But in reality, there was a lot of like temper tantruming with no act, like nothing changed. And we're seeing that we don't need another pipeline to bolster this industry. The amount of oil that's already being produced in the Alberta tar sands is quite significant. And that hasn't really dipped. Even with the drop of the price of oil, we saw like marginal, like negligible drops in the production. And what we did see is the stop of the expansion. And I think the KXL sort of is sending a message, we don't need to expand and we need to be shifting. What hasn't happened though is that shift. Instead, we have a government that's still deeply invested financially and politically in pushing forward the Trans Mountain pipeline. And we have a government that says we still need to expand the Alberta tar sands. The reality is the world is saying we need to move in other directions. And the signal by Biden is that's the case. And I'm starting to see glimmers of hope that Canada is looking to move away from that. It doesn't help when Kenny goes, okay, fine, we won't expand the tar sands, we'll just dig up mountains for coal. You know, like the province here is a little bit off the charts of what we should be doing to address climate change. But as a whole, I think there's a clear signal globally, particularly with the KXL, that it's time for us to shift gears and look at what sustainable energy development looks like, and more importantly, what sustainable economic systems look like that are framed around a justice component that include the recognition of Indigenous rights.
There was a young brave who, before he was 10, played war games in the woods with his Indian friends. And he built a dream that when he grew up, he would be a fearless warrior, an Indian chief. Oh, many moons passed, and his dream grew strong, till tomorrow he would sing his first war song and fight his first battle. But something went wrong, a surprise attack killed him in his sleep at night. And so castles made of sand slips into the
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Arielle Duranger. She is the Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action. So, Arielle, over the past year in the United States, the Black Lives Matter movement has really taken on a whole new shape and has had a lot of wind at its back for a number of sad reasons, but it's also ignited a movement. How has the progress on the Black Lives Matter front and the work that you and your colleagues do with protecting the rights of Indigenous people in Canada mesh?
I think intersectionality is critical for climate justice. And within the context of understanding the importance of Black Lives Matters in relation to climate justice and the fight and for the advocacy of the inclusion of Indigenous rights within climate policy development in Canada, they absolutely have to come together. We talk about the same thing around immigrant and migrant rights in this country. It's the same thing when it comes to LGBTQI, to S rights. We have to be talking about the intersections of all of this, because the liberation of our communities is tied up in the liberation of other communities. And it's about looking at how we can challenge the systems of colonization, predatory capitalism, patriarchy, and largely systems of white supremacy. A lot of the structures and the colonial policy development and the way that we move forward laws and regulations are founded on systems of white supremacy that came with colonization. And we have to stand in solidarity with Black Lives Matter, because again, all of our liberations are tied together. We have to be looking at structural change. And when we talk about decolonizing Canada's climate policy, if we're able to achieve that, that looks at how we can address our own internalized white supremacy that exists. Like, the fact that we look to colonial structures to change things for us might not necessarily be the answer we're looking for. And we do have to look at how we can collectively, as like Black, Indigenous, peoples of color, look to change those structures, because a lot of the migrant folks that come here are fleeing from countries as refugees. And these are countries that are both politically unstable, but also climate-wise. Climate change has hit many, like Syria was hit by droughts, which led to a lot of the political unrest in a country that didn't have a strong democratic foundation to start with. And that led to massive refugees coming to multiple, or going to multiple different countries for refuge. And we have to talk about, like, where is our internalized oppression, our internalized biases, even as Indigenous peoples, to looking at to white folks and colonial societies as the places we go to save us from these situations and challenges. And within Black Lives Matters, there's a lot of calls for Black people to lead Black challenges with policing and the brutality and violence that they feel, and Indigenous peoples are doing the same. This is a lot. Like, this conversation and what you're bringing up is actually a lot about healing. And there is a tremendous amount of healing that needs to happen to heal from systems of colonization and white supremacy, and not just at the hands of BIPOC folks, but white folks and settler society need to also heal from the trauma that they have inflicted on others, and that has continued to be perpetuated through the structures of governance and laws that continue to hold all the power in these countries. And we have to engage in our individual healing and our collective community healing and our intersectional healing as a whole, as BIPOC and settler societies together.
Sorry, what does BIPOC stand for? I'm not familiar with it.
Black, Indigenous, people of color.
Okay.
So it's just to name all the different people, like non-white folks. And it's complicated, you know, like talking about white supremacy is a complicated thing, because whiteness is a system that was created. If you look at the history of how white supremacy even started, like Irish, Scottish settlers that came to this country were treated just as poorly are close to just as poorly as indigenous and black folks because they were of a lower class in Europe. But then there was collective movements between those groups, between Scottish, Irish, black and indigenous peoples rising up against some of the sort of white slave owners and the people that were trying to create the Americas, the new land discovered. And they saw a way to divide those communities by saying that black folks were less than, and indigenous people, you had your own rights. We made treaties with you. And Irish and Scottish people, you're just like us. Look at our skin. And white supremacy and those systems really got played out to divide and conquer our peoples. But we have to look at healing from that collective trauma and how we can undo that harm caused by colonization and systems of imposed white supremacy that came along with it.
So with that intersectionality in mind, and also with the history in mind of the plights of indigenous peoples in both the US and Canada, if you were explaining the differences in the movements in both Canada and the US to somebody from another country, say Italy, and they didn't know anything about the differences, obviously there's a lot of overlap, but how would you explain to this person who's not really familiar with the historical context, how would you explain to them how the indigenous action in both countries differ?
I think there are striking differences between Canada and the United States as far as the acknowledgement of indigenous populations and our rights. So I would probably say Canada went through a process of treaty making with a majority of the indigenous populations of Canada, where the U.S. took a tactic of war. And that war led to, in the United States, the erasure both physical life and acknowledgement of Indigenous peoples for many generations. Whereas in Canada, because a treaty making process happened, there has been a conscious, like a sort of societal civic consciousness that Indigenous peoples have existed. We have moved Canada to existing, to acknowledging participation as a stakeholder in decision-making, whereas in the United States, they're only at a place where they're acknowledging Indigenous peoples as even peoples with equal rights in the United States. In both countries, Indigenous peoples were some of the last groups to be given the rights to vote in democratic elections. In Canada, we were the last. In the United States, they weren't quite the last. We're seeing that change with the election of Indigenous representatives in Senate in the United States, and which is something we achieved some time ago in Canada. The huge difference here is that there's a lot of lip service in Canada to Indigenous peoples being important without any tangible, actionable steps to address how we include Indigenous peoples within the structure of policy development and decision making. And the United States is, you know, I would say about a decade or two behind us in that trajectory.
Ariel Duranger, thank you so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Eddie Harris, Willie Dunn, and Tuckin Patty. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.